unruffled beat of Ray Lynch's Clouds Below Your Knees signals Wednesday, 8 p.m. and time for So What's Your Story? We're the only program originating in Houston devoted to live storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm your host, Warren Holloman. I'm proud to be a part of the best team on the radio. Along with my co-hosts, Mary, Greg, and Hank, our intern and production assistants, Tatiana and Teddy, and of course, media maven and engineer, Nicole Rochelin Grady. Hey, Nicole. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm fine, but I'm not taking final exams right now.
Neither am I. I'm at the radio.
But I know exams are on your mind. I hope they're going well.
Actually, they are. This first one, I had to write a 5 to 7 page paper, and I have two more to do after that. And so, you know, it's been a little dueling. However, I'm making it. I'm so far I have straight A's. So if I keep it that way.
We're so proud of you and so appreciative of your coming in here during final exam week.
Thank you. As well as Tatiana. I know she's grinding it hard as well.
Yes, Tatiana as well. Each week on So What's Your Story, we revel in the power of story by placing the spotlight on remarkable tellers, both starters and stars, who engage us with stirring personal stories as well as treasured traditional folk tales, and who take us on captivating journeys, and then they return us safely to the present. Tonight, we're going to try something a little different from our usual routine. Our storyteller will definitely be someone you consider a star, not a starter. But we're going to depart from the routine of having a live teller. In fact, tonight's teller died in 1990. Thus, we'll rely heavily on recordings that have been preserved on the internet. Perhaps you've figured out by now, but tonight's guest is none other than John Henry Falk. For some time, I've wanted to do a tribute show devoted to this Texas legend, to his stories, his life, and especially to what he stood for at a time in our nation's history that called for great courage and sacrifice. It's hard, I suppose, to be from Texas and not know who John Henry Falk was. He has touched so much of Texas life and culture. For example, Hank and I were talking about the Tejas Storytelling Association and the particular way that they honored him. And I'm going to ask Hank to say a word about that.
Yeah, the Tejas Storytelling Association is really as much of a legend as John Henry Falk himself. Mm-hmm. It is one of the most well-renowned storytelling associations, not only in the country, but also internationally. Mm-hmm. And it also sponsors one of, if not, I believe, the largest American Storytelling Festival annually. So it is a big deal. And, you know, I'm always happy to talk about Tejas because we've had so many tellers on the air who's actually been winners. So, for example, just a few of the winners of the John Henry Falk, Trefine Hickman, the Cedar Hills, Dallas area, Peggy Helmick Richardson in Dallas, Mary Grace Kettner in San Antonio, Marianne Blue in San Antonio, Jay Staley, a very good friend of mine, who's also an adjunct in the Communication Division in the Department of Arts and Communication at UHD. He's been a guild member for about 20 years. He's been on the show a half a dozen times, and he's actually won this award twice. Also, Ole Kastner, magnificent Texas folk teller, has won the award, and Sheila Starks Phillips, who's been on the air. We have really had some wonderful Falk Award winners grace this studio.
And if you've spent any time in Austin, it's hard to walk down the street and not see Falk's name on buildings and streets and other parks and things. And then Greg happened to be here, and he's lived in Austin. I asked him to comment on that.
Well, absolutely. I like to think that maybe John Henry Falk was one of the original Keep Austin Weird folks. maybe not in name, but he's a vibrant part. And, you know, you'll see that the central campus of the Austin Public Library System is named mm-hmm. the John Henry Falk Building. And on it, if you look carefully, you will find a plaque. And excuse me, I think all of our voices are a little wonky tonight, thanks to the Houston allergies. But John Henry Falk was born in Austin, Texas in 1913. And he grew up in a 19th century house on West Live Oak Avenue in South Austin, where my sister used to live. Known today as Green Pastures Restaurant. It's very cool to go to this restaurant and think about John Henry Falk strolling the grounds and thinking of his stories there. And I'm sure entertaining his friends there on many a great night. While at the University of Texas, he became a pupil of noted folklorist and storyteller J. Frank Dobie and completed his master's thesis entitled 10 Negro Sermons. After service with the Merchant Marines, the American Red Cross, and the U.S. Army during World War II, he moved to New York, where from 1947 to 1956, his homespun humor won the hearts of many who listened to his daily radio programs or saw him as a TV host or a panelist. And I know he was on To Tell the Truth. I've seen him on that. Mm-hmm. Elected vice president of the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists, John Henry was determined that the Actors Union take a stand against the McCarthyite practice of blacklisting entertainers with alleged connections to the Communist Party. As a result, he himself was blacklisted and lost his jobs in radio and television. With the help of attorney Lois Neisser, he filed and won, after a six-year battle, the largest libel judgment ever awarded at the time. John Henry Falk's later career included small parts in movies, regular appearances on TV's Hee Haw and stage shows, including the one-man Pear Orchard, Texas, which he wrote and began performing in 1986. He often appeared on the lecture circuit, where he mixes down-to-earth humor with strong support for intellectual freedom and the First Amendment. John Henry Falk died in Austin, Texas, on April 9th, 1990, at the age of 76.
Thanks, Greg. So that's a brief bio. And for the rest of the show, we're sort of going to flesh it out in more detail, telling stories from each period of his life. I'm guessing if you're from Texas and you're of a certain age at least, you probably knew most of that stuff, or at least you should have. But like a lot of Houstonians, I did not grow up in Texas, and it took me a little longer to become acquainted with this legendary Texas storyteller. I grew up in eastern North Carolina, and I still remember my first encounter with John Henry Falk. It was one Christmas morning, 1974. I was a sophomore in college, home for the holidays, home from college in the Northeast, and a little drunk on the idea that the South was the place I wanted to be from, rather than to stay in, and that the Northeast was the sort of progressive, enlightened part of the country. That's what I was thinking at the time. And then I heard this country storyteller whose voice sounded a whole lot like my father's, and he was saying things that really struck home and made sense in a deep and profound way. So let me set the scene. It's Christmas morning. I stumble into the kitchen. My parents are listening to WUNC. That's the public radio station in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And my mom and dad had this hushed excitement. They said, "Listen, they're about to play a story by John Henry Falk." I said, "Who's that?" They said, "Shh, we'll tell you later. Listen." And this is the story I heard.
Day.
The day after Christmas, a number of years ago, I was driving down a country road in Texas, and it was a bitter cold, cold morning. And walking ahead of me on the gravel road was a little barefooted boy with nondescript ragged overalls and a makeshift sleeve of a sweater tied around his little ears. I stopped and picked him up. Looked like he was about 12 years old, and his little feet were blue with the cold. He's carrying an orange. And he got in and had the brightest blue eyes one ever saw, and he turned a bright smile on my face and says, "I'm going down the road about 2 miles to my cousin's. I want to show him my orange old Sandy Claus brought me." Well, I wasn't going to mention Christmas to him because I figured he came from a family that kind of don't have Christmas. But he brought it up himself. He said, "Did old Sandy Claus come to see you, mister?" And I said, "Yes, we had a real nice Christmas at our house, and I hope you had the same." He paused for a moment, looked at me, and then with all the sincerity in the world said, Mister, we had the wonderfulest Christmas in the new nine states down to our place. Lordy, it was the first one we ever had there. See, we never do have them out there much. Don't notice when Christmas time comes. We'd heard about it, but never did have one because, well, you know, it just... Papa says that old Santa Claus, Papa hoorahs a lot, said old Santa Claus was scared to bring his reindeer down into our section of the county because folks down there are so hard up that they liable to catch one of his reindeer and butcher him for meat. But just several days before Christmas, a lady come out from town, and she told all the families through there, our family too, that there was old Santa Claus was coming town to leave some things for us, and if Papa'd go in town, he could get some Christmas time for all of us. And Papa hooked up the mule wagon. He went in town, but he told us children, said, now don't y'all get all worked up and excited because there might not be nothing to this yarn that lady told. And but shucks, he hadn't got out of sight up the lane there till we was done watching for him to come back. And we couldn't get our minds on nothing else, you know. And Mama, she'd come door every once in a while and say, now y'all quit that looking up the lane because Papa told you there might not be nothing. And, but long about the middle of the afternoon, well, we heard the team of jangling harness coming, and we ran out in the front yard, and Ernie, my little brother, called out, said, yonder come Papa, and here come them mules just in a big trot, you know, and Papa standing up right in the bed of that wagon holding two big old chickens, all feathers picked off, and he was just yelling, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas, and the team stopped right in front of the gate, and all us children just went swarming out there like a flock of chee-chees, you know, and just crawling over that wagon and looking in. And, mister, I wished you could have seen what was in that wagon. It's bags of stripedy candy and apples and oranges and sacks of flour and some real coffee, you know, and just all tinsely and pretty, and we couldn't say nothing, just kind of held her breath and looked at it, you know, and Papa standing there just waving them two chickens and yelling, Merry Christmas to you, Merry Christmas to you, and a laughing, that big old grin on his face. And Mama, she come a-hurrying out with the baby in her arms, you know, and when she looked in that wagon, she just stopped, and Papa, he dropped them two chickens and retched and caught the baby out of her arms, you know, and held him up and said, Merry Christmas to you, Santa Claus, and baby little old Alvie Lee, he just laughed like he knowed it was Christmas too, you know. And Mama, she started telling us to name all it, them nuts. It wasn't just peanuts. She had names for all of them. Mama knows a heap of things like that. She'd seen that stuff before, you know. And we's all of us just a-chattering and a-going on at the same time, us young'uns are looking in there. And all of a sudden, we heard Papa call out, Merry Christmas to you, Sam Jackson. And we stopped and looked, and here comes Sam Jackson leading that old cripple-legged mule of his up the lane. And Papa said, Sam Jackson, did you get in town to get some Christmas this year? Sam Jackson, you know, he sharecrops over there across the creek from our place. And he shook his head and said, well, no, sir, Mr. Will, I didn't go in town. I heard about that, but I didn't know it was for colored folks, too. I thought it was just for you white families. All of a sudden, none of us children were saying nothing. Papa, he looked down at Mama. Mama looked up at him, and they didn't say nothing like they don't a heap of times, but they know what the others are thinking. They're like that, you know. And all of a sudden, Papa, he broke out in a big grin again. He said, Dad, blame it, Sam Jackson, it's sure a good thing you come by here. Lord have mercy, I like to forgot. Old Santa Claus would have me in court if he'd heard about this. The last thing he asked me if I lived out here near you. Said he hadn't seen you around and said he wanted me to bring part of this out here to you and your family, your woman and your children. Well, sir, Sam Jackson, he broke out in a big grin. And Papa said, I'll tell you what to do. You get your wife and children and you come down here tomorrow morning. It's going to be Christmas time all day long. Come early and stay late. And Sam Jackson said, you reckon? And Mama called out to him and said, yes, and you tell your wife to be sure and bring some pots and pans because we're going to have a heap of cooking to do, and I ain't sure I've got enough to take care of all of it. Well, sir, old Sam Jackson, he started off leading that mule up the lane in a full trot, you know, and he was heading home to get the word to his folks and his children, you know, and next morning it... You remember how it was yesterday morning? Just rosy red and looked like Christmas time. It was cold, but you didn't notice the cold, you know, and the sun just come up, just all rosy red, and us young'uns were all out of bed before daylight, seemed like, just running in the kitchen and smelling and looking, and it was all there, sure enough. And here comes Sam Jackson and his team and his wife and his five young'uns in there, and it's all looking over the edge, and we run out and yell, "Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas." And Papa said, "Christmas gift to you, Sam Jackson. Y'all come on in." And they come in, and Mama and Sister Jackson, they got in the kitchen, and they started cooking things up. And us young'uns started playing Christmas time. And it's a lot of fun, you know. We just play Christmas gift with one another and run around and around the house and just roll in the dirt, you know. And then we started playing go up to the kitchen door and smell. And we'd run up and smell inside that kitchen door where Mom and Sister Jackson was cooking at, and then we'd just die laughing and roll in the dirt, you know, and go chasing around and playing Christmas gift. And we played Christmas time till we just wore ourselves out. And Papa and Sam Jackson, they'd put a table up and put some sheets over it, some boards up over some sawhorses. And everybody had a place, even the baby. And Mom and Sister Jackson said, "Well, now it's ready. Come on in, we're going to have Christmas dinner." And I sit right next to Willie Jackson, you know, and he'd just roll his eyes at me, and I'd roll mine, and we'd just die laughing, you know. And there was an apple and an orange and some stripedy candy at everybody's place, and that was just dessert. See, that wasn't a real Christmas dinner. Mom and them had done cooked that up, and they just had it spread up and down the table. And so Papa and Sam Jackson, they'd been sitting on the front porch, and they come in. Papa, he sit at one end of the table, and Sam Jackson sit at the other, and it was just a beautiful table like you never had seen. And I didn't know nothing could ever look like that and smell that good, you know. And Sam Jackson, you know, he's real black, and he had on that white clean shirt of his and them overhauls. Everything had been washed and was real clean. Papa, he said, "Brother Jackson, I believe you're a deacon in the church. I ain't much of a church man myself, but I believe you're a deacon. Maybe you'd be willing to give grace." Well, Sam Jackson, he stood up there, and his hands was real big, and he kind of held on to the side of the table, you know. But he didn't bow his head like a heap of folks do when they're saying blessing. He just looked up and smiled, and he said, "Lord, I hope you're having as nice a Christmas up there with your angels as we have it down here, because it's sure is Christmas time down here. And I just wanted to say Merry Christmas to you, Lord." Like I say, mister, I believe that was the wonderfulest Christmas in the United States of America.
The Christmas Story.
The story you've just heard is John Henry Falk's Christmas Story. It was actually based on a real-life experience that occurred in South Austin during his childhood. And the version you heard was a 1994 rebroadcast from NPR's Weekend Edition. The original broadcast was on NPR's Voices in the Wind back in 1974. This story strikes a number of chords to me. I think there's certainly a religious chord. He reminds us that Christmas isn't about big things, it's about little things, and it's not the size of the present, it's the size of the love that gives it and the gratitude that receives it. The other day, our president spoke in Utah and proclaimed, and I quote directly, "Christmas is back, bigger and better than before, and we say it now with pride." And I think John Henry Falk would have a bone to pick with that concept of Christmas. I think the story also strikes a political chord. I think we tend to forget that Texas and the South at one time were the harbor to a fair amount of progressive political thinking. John Henry Falk's father was a member of the Populist Party back around the turn of the 20th century. He even ran for governor, I believe, on that ticket. And that connects with me because my grandfather was also a populist. And I grew up with a family saying, equal rights to all, special privileges to none. And I think that extends to the way we celebrate Christmas as well as everything else. And so that story struck a chord for that reason. And then there was a third thing I just have to say. I grew up with my mother reminding me every Christmas morning that for her, during the Depression, they only got two gifts. One, and they both were stuffed into a sock. Nuts, which was no big deal. Pecans and walnuts grew on the farm. But the big deal was the orange. On Christmas Day, every child got an orange. And that was truly special. And I think that's an example of why stories can be so powerful. They can connect us to people and causes in a way we had not imagined. The way that connected me and helped me to appreciate what my mother had been through. And they can inspire and motivate us. If you're just joining us, this is So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. You can catch us at 89.5 in Galveston, 91.9 in Huntsville, and online at www.kpft.org. Tonight we're doing a tribute show to John Henry Faulk, and that first segment you just heard is what is perhaps his most replayed story, and of course very appropriate for the holiday season. In the second segment now, I'd like to focus on the thing that made Faulk famous on a national level, his courage and sacrifice in the face of McCarthyism and the Red Scare of the 1950s. Just a bit of background. So let's go back to the late 40s, early 50s. Faulk had left University of Texas in Austin, and he now was in New York City, and he was a huge success. He had his own radio show on WCBS, which is a big deal because that was the flagship station of CBS during a time when radio was king, the time just before television. And on the show, he would spin yarns, he would reminisce about his Texas childhood, and he would comment on the events of the day. And people were comparing him to Mark Twain and Will Rogers and people like that from a generation or two before. He would spin those yarns, he would reminisce, and he would use all those narratives and all that humor as a way of commenting on the foibles of human nature as well as the events of the day. And the sophisticated New York City audience loved this Texan. Sometimes they didn't know exactly whether they were laughing at him or with him, but they loved listening to him. And I said he commented on the events of the day. Well, that's what got him into trouble. This was the 1950s, the McCarthy era, Cold War, time of blacklists, suspicions. Senator Joe McCarthy, of course, from Wisconsin, and we should add his sort of sidekick, Richard Milhouse Nixon, from California. And under the guise of trying to root out communism from the country, they became what you might call domestic terrorists in their own right. They alleged that numerous communist Soviet spies and communist sympathizers had infiltrated the highest levels, they said, of the U.S. government, the universities, the film industry. And they started naming names of those they suspected, and they damaged a lot of careers. And John Henry Faulk, of course, is one who was blacklisted, and he never recovered from this in terms of his career. But he wasn't the only one. I mean, people like Helen Keller were blacklisted. Burl Ives, Pete Seeger, Artie Shaw, Zero Mostel, and Charlie Chaplin, Orson Welles. In fact, Chaplin and Welles were essentially deported, and they never spent significant time back in the U.S. So Faulk was involved in the union of actors and radio and TV industry employees, and he made it his mission to combat this craziness and advocate for the First Amendment rights of entertainers. And I'm going to ask Nicole to play an interview that was recorded in 1980 by Bill Moyers, and he's asking Faulk to reflect on that very difficult period of history and certainly a painful time with him when his career was essentially destroyed. And I'm going to warn you, it contains Faulk's famous chicken snake story. Nicole?
Bill Moyers about that.
I was at William and Mary College in Williamsburg last week, about 2 weeks after you were there.
And I was intrigued by all the publicity that still was following in your wake.
Wasn't that nice?
Yeah, you know, when you went there, they didn't know who John Henry Falk was. These undergraduates hadn't been born when you were suffering your ordeal back in the 50s. And yet, according to the press and my sources there, when you finished speaking, they gave you a standing ovation.
Yeah, honey, you know, Mama had aimed me toward the Methodist ministry. But by the time I got born, she realized she shot a blank. I still have an evangelical streak in me, apparently, because I used it there at that thing. I got to talk about the First Amendment, got to talk about the McCarthy period, and the trivialization of our most meaningful national experience, namely the election of our federal officers, the president, and on down. And I got so carried away, I started saving souls, Bill. I really did. I got kind of state of joy at it.
Did they know what you were talking about, these young kids at this very traditional college?
See, I do a great many college speeches, and that's the reason I do, is that I'm determined that they shall remember that they shall know what the McCarthy period was all about. And it's not taught in our schools. The meaning of McCarthyism has never been taught. See, it's supposed to be an anti-communist movement. It had nothing to do with communism, anti or otherwise.
What was it?
At that time, the use of communism, see, was a way of bolstering up, number one, the Cold War that was opening up. And number two, and most important of all, and this is terribly important to understand the McCarthy period, it was a way of shutting off the dialogue. The life's blood of this country is an open and robust dialogue, a rational political dialogue where everybody's free to say what they believe, why they believe it, and to persuade their neighbor to their point of view. That is the way we move forward in our society.
Well, what happened in the 50s was that the way to silence your opponent was to call him a communist.
But we were told that there was an international communist conspiracy afoot, and it had its bony hand right on the White House door. And Roosevelt and that crowd of cronies that he had there were nothing but a bunch of old communistic things. I had an aunt that said, Johnny, they just scare me to death when I think they're right there in Washington, D.C., fixing to take over this government any day. And I said, hey, Edith, the people of this country are not going to put communists in charge of anything. You just don't know. You just don't know, Johnny.
What's that story you tell about when you were 12 years old, your mother sent you out to the hen house to look for the chicken snake that was harassing the hen?
Well, I use that usually to illustrate that. Booch Cooper and I were law and order men. I was a Texas Ranger, and he was a United States Marshal.
When you were playing as kids?
We were both 12 years old, and we rode the frontier between Mama's back door and her hen house and the cow barn out there. We lived out in South Austin, Texas. And Mama told us there was a chicken snake in one of the hen's nests out there. Would we mighty lawmen go out and execute it? We both of us barefooted in overalls, and we laid aside our stick horses, got a hoe, and went in, and the hens were in a state of acute agitation, and they had the crane in their necks, and we had to stand on tiptoe to look in the top tier of nests, and about the third top nest we looked in, a chicken snake looked out of. And I don't know, Bill, whether you've ever viewed a chicken snake from the distance of 6 inches from the end of your nose.
Not that close. But
the damn things look like a boa constrictor from that distance, although it's about the size of your finger. And Boots and I, all of our frontier courage drained out our heels. Actually, it trickled down our overall legs. And Boots and I made a new door through the hen house wall. And Mama came out and said, well, you've lulled me into a sense of false security. I thought I was safe from all hurt and harm, and here you've let a chicken snake run you out of the hen house. And a little chicken snake at that. Don't you know chicken snakes are harmless? They can't hurt you. Luke said, yes, sir, Miss Falk, I know that. And he rubbing his forehead and his behind at the same time. Said, but they scare you so bad, it'll cause you to hurt yourself.
And that's what happened.
This is what happened to us during that period, Bill.
We became so frightened of the...
And our own freedoms.
Yeah.
And see, the men who erected the protections for the individual Americans back there 200 years ago believed that we would be capable of governing ourselves. And they knew in order for us to be, they would have to make it an absolute mandate. Anything of lesser force wouldn't survive the kind of crisis that they knew would come. They were men of great wisdom and vision, literate men.
But they didn't put a Bill of Rights in the Constitution until the people demanded it.
You know, that is lost on so many scholars and almost as many judges. And I don't know, I'm not lambasting the federal judiciary, but they at least should be acquainted as how we came to have a Bill of Rights.
Have you ever thought of how beautifully constructed, how wonderfully crafted that First Amendment is?
Ooh, yes, I've thought of that a great, great deal.
You know what it says? Literally?
Yes.
Congress shall make no law
respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging freedom of speech, or the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and petition their government for the redress of grievances.
Why are you so passionate about the First Amendment in particular? I mean, you did bring those students at William and Mary to their feet talking about this.
This is because it puts every American citizen, whatever color, whatever walk of life, on precisely the same footing, just as your right to vote puts you on the same footing with the heads of the party, with the richest men, all the Rockefeller boys.
But the fact of the matter is, the First Amendment didn't protect you in the 1950s.
Oh, yes, it did.
You lost your job.
That's right.
You lost your career.
The hell is... They didn't mention that he was a member.
Cut off that last comment, but John Henry Falk ended that interview by exclaiming, "What the hell is a job?" Which was somewhat ironic because he lost a job, he lost a career. He went back to Austin, took a job as working for an advertising firm. He never returned to the national stage in terms of entertainment, but he was a man of principle, and I think he had his priorities. If you're just tuning in, this is So What's Your Story on 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. I'm Warren Holloman. I'm hosting tonight's show. And now I'm going to check in with Nicole Rocherlin and Tatiana so they can tell us what's on our community calendar. Nicole?
A big thank you, as always, to our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. The Guild will not have a December meeting, unfortunately, but they've got something special coming up in January. HSG is partnering with Company On Stage to create a new storytelling series in the company's newly renovated theater in the Salem Lutheran Church, and that's at 4930 West Belford in Houston. Now, the program will launch in January on Friday, January 12th, and Saturday, January 13th at 7 p.m. It will be an all-age show with the title Animal Voices. Tatiana?
The next Houston Moth Story Slam will be Tuesday, December 19th at Warehouse Live. The theme is dirt. You'll hear stories about digging it, dishing it, spreading it, and hosing it off. Or tell a story of your own dirty little secret. And if you do, remember it's all about talking dirty.
Well, as for our show, remember, you can catch us on kpft.org, Facebook Live, and Instagram. Don't forget our YouTube channel as well. If you visit our Facebook page, tell us what you are thinking about our shows and suggest program ideas. We want to know, and we promise we'll get back to you. Be sure to share our page with your friends, and we'd love it if you like us before you leave. And if that's not enough, make sure, again, check out our YouTube channel.
Thanks, guys. Lots of great storytelling activities all over Houston and right here as well. Now back to John Henry Falk. In the second segment, we focused on Falk's heroism during the McCarthy era and his crazy, powerful story about a chicken snake that pretty much summed up what was wrong with America in the 1950s. And not just then. We see those chicken snake reactions today as well. Now, moving forward into the third segment, I'd like to focus on how John Henry Falk continued to be a prophetic voice during the 70s and 80s. We're going to play four very brief clips, like 2 minutes each, all from a documentary called Falk at His Finest, which was produced by Alternative View Television. The first story is about Falk's old nemesis from the early 50s, Richard Milhouse Nixon. Nicole?
Daddy told him the South had lost the Civil War, and he's been
pouting about it ever since. Got a big sign over his fireplace, "Yankee beware. Robert E. Lee might have surrendered, but I ain't." And he embodies most of the philosophy and thoughts and outrage that people we hear with
from that
particular political point of view.
You used, as cutting that snodgrass real well, to roast Richard Nixon over and the Watergate situation in your.
Gerald Ford McCumber. "If I asked you, said Dick Nixon, I'd go down to the Capitol and hire the best lawyer I could get a hold of, a gem-cracking lawyer, and I'd fly at them rascals. I'd swear and aver and get a cease and desist order and a habeas corpus and all such as that. And I would aver as follows. My name is Richard Nixon, better known as Tricky Dickie. When I run in 1972, I run not as a stranger, but as one of the best known men in the new United States of America, and I'd been known as Tricky Dickie for 20 years. And yet you gave me a overwhelming mandate." And he did get an overwhelming. "When I run in 1968, I said I would end the war in Vietnam, had a secret plan for it. And 4 years later, I'd spread it all over the map of Southeast Asia. Killed more people and done more bombing than had been did before. And yet in 1972, after all of that, you gave me a mandate." I go down the list about 10 things. "Now you pick me up off of running a red light called Watergate, for God's sakes. Look at my face. You say I'm a crook? You say you can't believe me? Well, listen, America, you'd better look in the mirror and see your own face. I've just been doing it the way you wanted it done, that's all. I'm a reflection of you." And, ooh, you could send an audience tearing its hair, you know, because every one of them had voted for him, and old Spiro Agnew, and everything he was saying was absolutely true there.
What I find particularly striking in that clip is the way Falk ends the story and the conversation by placing the blame not on the politician, but the people who voted him into office, saying that he only gave you what you asked for. And I think as I've listened to Falk's stories and interviews, I've noticed that's an ongoing theme in his message, that an informed electorate is the best protection we have against losing the First Amendment and our democratic way of life. Now, this next clip moves forward a couple of presidents to Ronald Reagan and to his infamous Grenada invasion. Since this was not exactly the most memorable moment in U.S. history or the most memorable war, let me give you a little bit of background. It happened in 1983. It was codenamed Operation Urgent Fury, which was a little ironic because most people thought it was anything but urgent or a matter of fury. The tiny nation of Grenada did not exactly pose a clear and present danger to the United States of America. With a population of 90,000, it was about the size of Conroe, Texas. But we sent the Marines in there and made a big to-do over it. And by the way, there were lots of other countries around the world that were not exactly democracies at the time, and we were not invading those sovereign countries. On the other hand, in defense of President Reagan, there had been a coup, and the government was being run by a leftist military junta, and I think this had shades of Castro and Cuba in the American imagination. And the other factor was there were 600 U.S. medical students on the island, and at that time, nobody wanted a repeat of the Iran hostage crisis that had occurred in Jimmy Carter's presidency. After the invasion, actually, the U.S. reaction was largely, many people in the U.S. were very happy about this good little war that we had, which had very little risk and a lot of gain. The United Nations General Assembly was not so happy. They voted 108-9 to condemn it as, quote, a flagrant violation of international law, of the sovereignty of a nation. At any rate, I'd like you to hear what John Henry Falk has to say about that little war. Nicole?
And I jumped him the other day on it. He jumped me. He said, "Johnny, I know you hear what this old students out at the university are doing. They're protesting that there Grenada war down there that Ronnie's trying to run. It's just disgusting. They get out there and they start that protesting business and protesting business. I think they just ought to do something to them." I said, "Now, wait a minute, Cousin Ed. Don't you believe in the right to dissent?" "Of course I believe in the right to dissent. I'd knock a man's teeth down his throat that interfere with my right to dissent. Ronnie believes in the right to dissent. What him and me's trying to put a stop to is this criticism. Criticize, criticize, criticize. Why can't they leave Ronald Reagan alone and let him fight his wars in peace? They want to criticize somebody, let them go down there and criticize old Castro and that crowd of heathens. Johnny, we got there to Grenada just in time. Oh, my God, you don't understand what was going on." "Ronnie does, though. Do you know that bunch of rascals down there was planning to attack us any morning? They've got us pinned in here between the Gulf of Mexico and the Arctic Circle. And gonna come a-sweeping in here like a dose of salts through a widow woman. Throwing guns down on us, all of us, and making us sign our names to test papers and such as that, that we come, that we'll be Marxist-Leninist or they won't let us up again. I'll tell you, Ronnie has just saved America. That's what he's done, from an invasion of them rascals."
So that story has a lot of classic lines. Ronnie and me believe in the right to dissent. What him and me is trying to put a stop to is this criticism. Note the way he points out the kind of the hypocrisy of the time. He uses a lot of irony and humor. I'm thinking, here's a man who lives in what's become by now a red state, and he's sort of a blue politician. And he had to find a way to talk about these things that would work. And by using story, by using humor, by using irony, by creating these characters that and letting them tell the story from their perspective, I think he went a long way toward being the evangelist that he says that his mother wanted him to be. I'm now going to move forward. And we're going to hear a clip about Ronald Reagan's foreign policy. You'll when you hear this clip, you'll hear a name that some of you youngsters may not recognize. John Tower was a Texas senator in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. He was actually the first Republican senator from Texas since Reconstruction. He took LBJ's seat when LBJ became vice president in 1961. I think we all remember that, right? Right. And he had some personality quirks that tended to result in him being the butt of a few jokes. He was very short. He wore these very high-heeled boots, and he was very sensitive about that issue. So that's probably why Falk pulls him into this story. And I'd like you to note as you listen the way Falk cleverly uses narrative and fictional characters to make some very serious points about politics and human nature.
"A friend of mine is a great champion of the Reagan administration to explain Ronald Reagan's foreign policy to me. And he says, 'Oh, I'm glad you asked me that. Let me tell you something, honey. It's just as clear and simple as you please. It's easy to understand. John Tower, Senator Tower, explained it to me the other day. Johnny, it's this way. I can tell it to you because I can discuss it honestly. You know, Ronald Reagan loves the truth, and I love the truth, and I love to tell it in a plain English, the language the Holy Bible was wrote in. The language that old mother of mine spoke. I sometimes think that the Almighty, in his divine wisdom, when he saw fit to create his most perfect work here on earth, selected the Lone Star State of Texas as paradise on earth.
And he came to this Garden of Eden on Earth, Travis County, Texas. And he caught the gold from the Texas sunrise, and he caught the sweetest notes from the throat of the Texas mockingbird, our state bird. And he caught the perfume of the Texas blue bonnet, our state flower. And he compounded and molded it all together into that quintessence of sweetness and that epitome of all virtue and goodness. My mother. Well, now, son, that's what Ronald Reagan's foreign program's all about. And if you don't understand it fully, I'll explain it further.
So if that's not brilliant satire, I don't know what is. It's not exactly a coherent foreign policy, is it? But I think that was his point. A lot of talk about mom and dad and apple pie and about the blue bonnet and the mockingbird. And suddenly there's an emotional attachment to this policy, but not much substance to it.
Isn't that part of what makes him a brilliant storyteller?
Oh, I agree entirely. A brilliant political commentator who uses story to really give some very serious commentaries, what I would
and
say.
To capture the listener. You know, I mean, I'm with him. A few words into it, I can just feel the place and time, and, you know, I'm transported.
I agree. So we're going to wrap up this segment with one more short clip from Falk's work in the 70s and 80s. And this is a story that's not about politics at all, at least as far as I can discern. Or maybe it is, and I haven't figured it out yet. But John Henry, be patient with me. I think we'll all agree that it's funny. And it's from the one-man show he did in the 80s about a mythical town that was set in a mythical town called Pear Orchard, Texas. John Henry always said it was easy to find Pear Orchard because it was right there between two other well-known Texas towns, Beaumont and El Paso. And so, Nicole, could you play for us the story about John Henry visiting Pear Orchard and stopping to ask for directions?
And as the edge of town, I came to this little filling station grocery store and pulled up to get directions down to the courthouse, and it was an unremarkable filling station grocery store. There was a man leaning, sitting in a straight back chair, pushed back against the wall, dozing with his hat about half over his face, and in the gravel walkway there was a little boy playing stick horse on a double barrel shotgun, riding it as a stick horse, galloping up there, and that was very impressive as far as I was concerned. And so as I stopped at the gas pump, I didn't want gas, just was going to ask direction, this man came down in his chair. I said, "Wait, don't get up, mister. I just want to get directions. I don't want gas." And he said, "I can give you directions a heap cheaper than I can give you gasoline." And I said, "Well, can you tell me how to get down to the courthouse?" "Yes, sir, I sure can tell you how to go down there. You go down at that third red light, and Marvin, honey, Papa's asked you not to ride that shotgun around like that. It ain't no stick horse. He ain't supposed to ride it like that. It ain't nice for little boys to play with no loaded shotgun that way. You can't miss courthouse there. You swing right there. Papa, that courthouse been sitting there now since 1910. Papa helped build that. Papa was one of the carpenters on it. I say 1910. It could have been 1912. I ain't sure. Marvin, honey, quit a staring down the barrel of that shotgun. You go blow your head off and your mama wear you out, young man. And I tell you, old Judge Hawkins will tell you just exactly when that courthouse was built. Of course, I don't know what you're going there for. You might be going there to get you divorced or get married. You can't never tell. Marvin, honey,
Don't be pointing a shotgun at Papa. It ain't nice little boys pointing loaded shotguns at their daddies. Now, you take that in the house and put it up, honey. I've told you. Marvin, baby, don't be pointing it at the man in the car. It makes people nervous to point loaded shotguns at him. Yes, it does. What do you think he's laying down in that car like that for? Mister, don't try to drive off like that, laying down that away. Mister, he couldn't hit you if he was to shoot at you, mister. He ain't no shot at all. Mister, I wouldn't drive like that. And when you get to that third red light, it might be green.
That concludes the third segment of tonight's tribute to John Henry Falk. For the fourth and final segment, I wanted to just share a couple of things that other people have said about him that I think are some of the nicest tributes imaginable. One of the things we're going to share at the very end as we go off the air is a song called The Ballad of John Henry Falk. It was written and sung by Phil Oakes around 1970. Phil Oakes died tragically in 1976. He was only 36 years old. But I can't imagine a greater tribute to a storyteller than to have a song written about you, particularly a ballad. But what we'd like to play for you now is another way that Falk was honored, another way that storytellers can receive great honor, in my opinion, is if other people learn their stories and retell them. And if the person who's retelling your story is another Texas storytelling legend named Molly Ivins, then that's the greatest honor I could possibly imagine. And so, Nicole, I'd like to ask you to play Molly Ivins' version of the chicken snake story.
John Henry was one of the heroes of a bad time in this country, the McCarthy era. And that's when he took up freedom fighting as a serious thing. Not many people know this, but before he went into being a First Amendment defender, Johnny was in law enforcement. He was in the Texas Rangers, captain. He was 6 at the time. His friend Boots Cooper, who was 7, was the sheriff. And they used to do a lot of serious law enforcement out behind the Falk family place. One day, Johnny's mama, having two such fine lawmen right there on the property, said to them, "Boys, I want y'all to go down the hen house, get that chicken snake out of the hen house." Johnny and Boots were all excited about this big assignment. They galloped down there on their brooms. They tethered their brooms. Went in the hen house. Went through all the nests on the bottom shelf. No snake. They were of an age and of a size where to see up on the second shelf, they had to stand on tiptoe, see if there was a snake there, and there was. Now, I have never myself been nose-to-nose with a chicken snake, but I always took Johnny's word for it that it would just scare the living shit out of you. And it scared Johnny and Boots so bad they both tried to get out of the hen house at the same time, doing considerable damage to themselves and the hen house door in the process. But I came trailing back up the porch all shamefaced. Miss Falk looked at him and said, boys, what is wrong with you? You know perfectly well that a chicken steak will not hurt you. And that's when Boots Cooper said this semi-immortal thing. He said, yes, ma'am, but some things will scare you so bad you'll hurt yourself. Now, don't you know that's what we do again and again in this country? Get so scared. So scared of a real menace, not a chicken steak. Scared of communism, scared of crime, scared of drugs, scared of illegal aliens, scared of terrorists. So scared that we hurt ourselves, make the same mistake over and over again. We think we can make ourselves safer by making ourselves less free. I tell you something, when you make yourself less free, all that happens afterward is that you are less free. You are not safer.
God bless the late, great Molly Ivins, a beautiful, brilliant Texas wordsmith.
And this is Greg talking. And Warren, you know, I think my favorite part of your John Henry Falk stories was listening to about the little boy riding the shotgun. I could see it. I could feel it. And that is the brilliance of a wonderful storyteller.
Thank you, Greg. Well, that just about does it for tonight's show. Be sure to tune in next week when Hank is hosting. His guests include two noted Houston hairstylists who will share a variety of stories about their customers. And don't worry, no names.
I hear the stories are going to be hair-raising.
And his other guest will share a jaw-dropping, after the hair-raising, we'll drop some jaws, a jaw-dropping tale told by a storyteller grateful she's alive to tell it. It's the silly to the sublime next week when Hank hosts storytellers Heather Williams, Dave Ellis, and Sheldon Stack. Now, don't you dare move, because Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are waiting in the wings to share their cool classics with you. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story. And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Warren Holloman, along with Nicole Rocherlin and Greg and Hank and Tatiana and the entire SWYS team. We never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
His friends, they tried to warn him he was heading for a fall. If he spoke against the blacklist, he had no chance at all. But he laughed away their warnings and he laughed away their fears, for how could lies destroy the work of many honest years? Then slowly, oh so slowly, his life began to change. People would avoid his eyes, his friends were acting strange. And he finally saw the power of the hidden poison pen when they told him that his job was through, he'd never work again. And he could not believe what his sad eyes had found. He stared in disbelief as his world come tumbling down. And as the noose grew tighter, at last the trap was clear. For every place he turned to go, that list would soon be there, oh, that list. And is there any bottom to the fears that grow inside? Is there any bottom to the hate that you must hide? And is there any end to your long road of despair? Is there any end to the pain that you must bear? His wife and children trembled, the time was running short, when a man of law got on their side and took them into court. And there upon the stand they could not hide behind their lies, and the cancer of the fascist was displayed before our eyes. Hey, you blacklist, I've seen what you have done. I've seen the men you've ruined and the lives you tried to run. But the one thing that I've found...
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there.
We want to thank you, the listeners, and those who contributed to our successful fall fund drive. This is Interim General Manager Larry Winters asking you to please consider a year-end tax-deductible donation to your favorite Pacifica Foundation station, KPFT. This can be done in several different ways. You can call our business department at extension 314 at 713-526-4000 during business hours, or go to kpft.org, or go to kpftfacebook.com/kpfthouston. Then click on the donate button, and don't forget, you're listening to KPFT 90.1 in Houston.
We're like Bonnie and Clyde, Johnny and June, nothing to gain, nothing to lose. 1 foot in the grave, 1 foot up on the gas. There's mountains to climb, giants to slay, lessons to learn, prayers to pray, and there ain't no time for living in the past.